Thus have I heard. Once the Buddha was staying in Jivaka's mango grove near the city of Magadha with a company of 1,250 monks. Jivaka was the royal physician in the court of King Ajusatu. And he had given the mango grove to the Buddha and his monks to serve as a monastery. Now, one full moon night, King Ajusatu couldn't sleep. In fact, King Ajusatu had trouble sleeping every night. King Ajusatu had terrible insomnia. King Ajusatu had killed his father. King Ajusatu fell into bad company. The Buddha had a cousin who grew very jealous of the Buddha's standing and perceived power and influence and wanted to take over the Sangha for himself. And he figured the best way to do that was kill the Buddha. But he didn't have anybody around that could help him kill the Buddha, so he figured, well, I'll get some soldiers to kill the Buddha. Except the king in the local country was King Bimbisara, who was the Buddha's first protector, patron. King Bimbisara actually met the Buddha before the Buddha became the Buddha, back when he was Prince Siddhartha. And they had a very interesting encounter. And King Bimbisara said, when you figure out why they're suffering, you come back and tell me. I want to know. And the Buddha came back, and they got to be very, very good friends. And King Bimbisara was the Buddha's first patron. So he wasn't about to loan any soldiers to Devadatta so that Devadatta could kill the Buddha. However, King Bimbisara had a son, the crown prince, whose name was Ajusatu. And Devadatta convinced Ajusatu that it would be a good thing if they sort of took over from the guys in charge. And he convinced Ajusatu it would be a good thing to kill his father. So Ajusatu strapped a knife to his thigh, snuck into the palace, and promptly got caught. He was hauled before his father, and King Bimbisara said, why were you trying to kill me? And Ajusatu said, I wanted your kingdom. And Bimbisara said, well, if you want the kingdom here, you can have it. And gave him his crown and abdicated on the spot. And so Ajusatu became king and wound up loaning some soldiers to Devadatta so that Devadatta could have the Buddha killed. But the plot was found out. The soldiers never got anywhere near the Buddha, and nothing came of the plot to kill the Buddha. Except that Devadatta convinced Ajusatu that if he let former King Bimbisara just wander around loose, this might not come to a good end. Maybe former King Bimbisara might want to become king again. So Ajusatu had his father thrown in the dungeon, and he commanded that he not be fed. He allowed Bimbisara one visitor, his mother, the wife of King Bimbisara. And so the queen would visit the king in the dungeon, and the king wasn't dying. He wasn't starving to death. Because, you see, the queen was wrapping food up in her belt and was carrying it in to visit King Bimbisara, and he was being fed. And when Ajusatu found out, he commanded that his mother could no longer visit King Bimbisara. But still, King Bimbisara didn't die. So Ajusatu demanded he be tortured. And on the same day that Ajusatu received news that a son was born to him, He also received news that his father had died. And he finally understood a father's love for his son. And it was too late. And he was from that time on beset by horrible dreams. And so he couldn't sleep. So as I said, one full moon night, King Ajusatu couldn't sleep. Now when the king can't sleep, nobody sleeps. The king was up. All the ministers were up. Jivaka, the royal physician, was up. You know, it was party time at the palace. And King Ajusatu said, wouldn't it be nice, wouldn't it be wonderful to visit some recluse or Brahmin and have them teach us something spiritual? Perhaps they could give me something to ease my troubled mind. And at this, one of his ministers spoke up and said, there's so-and-so, he's long gone forth, he has a large collection of followers, maybe you should visit him. And some other minister spoke up about his guru and somebody else. And after about a half dozen ministers had spoken, the king turned to Jivaka and said, friend Jivaka, do you know of some recluse or Brahmin we could visit tonight? And Jivaka said, the Buddha is staying in my mango grove with a large company of 1,250 monks. Perhaps your majesty would like to visit the Buddha. Make the elephant vehicles ready, Jivaka. So Jivaka went down to the stables and had 500 female elephants saddled up, plus the king's royal bull elephant. And he returned to the king and said, the elephant vehicles are ready, your majesty. Do as you please. And the king mounted up 500 women on the 500 elephants, and he and Jivaka mounted up on the bull elephant, and they went forth in full royal splendor on this full moon night with servants carrying torches, and they went out of the palace and headed out towards the mango grove. And when they got near to the mango grove, the king became very afraid. You see, it was quiet. It was a little too quiet. Jivaka, are you plotting to turn me over to my enemies? It's too quiet in there for there to be 1,250 monks. There's no coughing, there's no sneezing, nobody's making a sound. It's too quiet. No, great king, I am not turning you over to your enemies. They're probably meditating. Look, you can see the lights of the pavilion hall. Let us go forward. So they went forward as far as they could on the elephants, and they dismounted, and they approached the pavilion hall. And King Ajusatu said to Jivaka, which one's the Buddha? He's the one sitting facing everybody else. And King Ajusatu went up close to the Buddha and marveled at how quiet and how peaceful this assembly was. And he said, oh, if only my son could see how peaceful this is. And the Buddha heard him and said, do your thoughts follow your affections, great king? And Ajusatu said, yes, they do. I would like it very much if my son could see how wonderful this assembly is, how peaceful this assembly is. And then King Ajusatu saluted the Buddha and sat down to one side. He said to the Buddha, venerable sir, may I ask you a question? Certainly, great king. In my kingdom, there are people who have many different occupations. There are soldiers, there are horse trainers, there are elephant trainers, there are charioteers, there are laundrymen, there are bath attendants, there are weavers, there are garland makers, there are cooks, there are bakers, there are people who build houses, there are artisans and craftsmen. Each person practices their craft, and there is a visible fruit of practicing this craft. It's possible to see what happens. They produce trained horses or trained elephants or artifacts of gold, or they make enough money so they can support their family. Venerable Sir, can you point out any fruit visible here and now of leading a spiritual life? The Buddha said, have you asked this question of any other teachers? The king said, yes, I have. I've asked about a half a dozen other teachers about it, but, you know, all they did was preach their doctrine to me. They never got around to answering my question. It was like inquiring about a mango and being told about a breadfruit. It was most unsatisfactory. So I ask you again, can you point out any fruit of the spiritual life visible here and now? May I ask you another question, great king? Certainly. Suppose in your household there was a servant, a slave, someone who rose early before you in the morning, helped fix your breakfast, waited on you all morning long, saw that you were fed at lunchtime, took care of you in the afternoon, saw that you got your dinner, waited on your every need in the evening, and went to bed after you. Suppose this slave were to think, how wonderful, how marvelous are meritorious deeds. The king is a human being, and I'm a human being. Yet the king has all these pleasures. He has me to wait on him hand and foot. Maybe if I were to do meritorious deeds, then I could rise into a greater station in my next lifetime. And this slave thinks about it, and after some time, he shaves off his hair and beard, puts on saffron robes, and joins my order. Upon hearing about this, great king, would you send your army to bring back this former slave? Oh, no, sir. We would salute him. We would bow down before him. We would give him food and clothing and shelter and medicine, and we would learn from him. We would respect him. Great king, this is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now. Well, the king had to allow that was so. But could you point out some other fruit of the spiritual life visible here and now? May I ask you a question? Certainly. Suppose there was a householder, a farmer, someone who worked very hard tilling his land and who paid a large amount of taxes into the royal revenue. Suppose he were to think, it's quite interesting. I'm a human. King Ajusatu is a human. And yet I work hard all day long just to pay taxes to him. Maybe if I were to do meritorious deeds, I could be reborn in a higher station. And so after some time, he shaves off his hair and beard, puts on saffron robes, and joins my order. Upon hearing of this, great king, would you send your soldiers to bring him back so that he would till his land again and pay taxes? Oh, no. We would bow down before him. We would give him food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. We would respect him. We would learn from him. This, too, is a fruit of the spiritual life. More wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Well, the king thought about it. He wasn't really satisfied. Could you point out some other fruit of the spiritual life visible here and now, more wondrous and more sublime than these two? Listen carefully, great king, and I will show you fruits of the spiritual life visible here and now, more wondrous and more sublime than these two. A Tathagata, a Buddha, a fully enlightened one, arises in this world. He preaches the Dharma, which is good at the beginning, good in the middle, and good at the end. Young men and women leave the lay life and join the order in order to learn this Dharma, which is good at the beginning, good in the middle, and good at the end. Great King, when someone joins my order, they undertake the precepts, the rules of conduct. The first of these rules, Great King, is I undertake the training to refrain from taking life. Great King, when one refrains from killing, one can sleep peacefully at night. The second of these rules, Great King, I undertake the training to refrain from taking what is not given. Great King, when one does not take what is not given, then one has ease in their life. One is not worried. One has a peaceful life. We have many rules, Great King, about sexual behavior, about telling the truth, about not taking intoxicants. There are 227 of these rules, Great King. They serve to guide us in how we lead our lives. When we lead our lives in accordance to these rules, it enables us to practice restraint of the sense faculties. We can be careful as to what we let into our beings, what we see, what we hear, smell, taste, touch, and even think about. By practicing this restraint, it gives us such a mind that we can be mindful of what we are doing, that we can have clear comprehension of all the things we do, whether walking or standing, seated or lying down. We can be aware. We can be aware when we are eating, when we are talking. Everything we do, we have this awareness. This mindfulness and clear comprehension allows us to lead our lives very simply. We don't need much. By looking carefully at all that is truly needed, we find that we only need food that we get by going on alms round, a few robes to serve as clothing, perhaps shelter like this nice mango grove that Jivaka has presented to us, and medicine if we become ill. Great King, in leading a simple life, it enables us to practice our meditation effectively. When we sit down to meditate, after having gone on alms round and eaten our one meal of the day, we can meditate with a calm and peaceful mind. We are able to overcome the five hindrances. Great King, these five hindrances are sensual desire, hatred and ill will, laziness and drowsiness, restlessness and worry, and skeptical doubt. Sensual desire is like being in debt. When one is in debt, one must do what one's creditors demand. Being freed from sensual desire is like getting out of debt. One is no longer having to always satisfy the person to whom one owes the money. Hatred and ill will, Great King, are like being sick. When one is sick, one cannot do what one wishes. One feels quite terrible. It's the same way with anger, with hatred, with ill will. But when a mind is free from hatred and ill will, it's like being healthy. One has the energy to do what one wishes to do. Laziness and drowsiness is like being in prison. When one is in prison, one cannot do anything. One must just be there. one misses out on all the excellent advantages of life. But when one overcomes laziness and drowsiness, it's like being liberated from prison. One can do what one wishes to do. Great King, restlessness and worry is like being a slave. One is exceedingly busy, going here, going there, but never able to do what one wants to do. One is at the command of someone else. When one's mind is liberated from restlessness and worry, it's like being freed from slavery. One is one's own master now and can do what one wishes to do. Great King, when someone is beset by skeptical doubt, it is like they are undertaking a perilous journey across the desert where there are thieves, no food, no water. One does not know whether to go this way, whether to go that way. One becomes lost, confused, maybe is set upon by bandits and killed. But if one overcomes skeptical doubt, it's like arriving at a place of safety where there's food and water and protection from thieves. Great King, when one is free from these five hindrances, one is able to meditate effectively. One is able to concentrate. One has arrived in a place where one's mind is purified enough so that the meditation will actually work. When one is secluded from sense desires, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, one can enter and remain in the first jhana, which is brought on by initial and sustained attention to the meditation subject, and is filled with rapture and joy. This rapture and joy completely fills one. One drenches, steeps, suffuses, and saturates one's being with this rapture and joy. Great King, think about a skilled bath attendant or his apprentice taking soap flakes and mixing them with water in a metal basin, mixing just the right amount of water so that the soap becomes a single homogeneous mass, that it is all filled with water and does not drip. Great King, in the first jhana, one is filled with this rapture and happiness so that it completely pervades one's being. This, Great King, is a visible fruit of the spiritual life, more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, Great King, one may enter and remain in the second jhana by taking the rapture and pushing it into the background and focusing on the joy. One arrives at a very sublime, concentrated state of mind. This joy is all pervasive. Imagine, Great King, a lake far up in the mountains with no streams flowing into it, no rain filling it from time to time, but a spring of cool, clear water coming in at the bottom of the lake. That cool, clear water will upwell, will fill the lake so that no part of the lake is not touched by cool, clear water. In the same way, Great King, in the second jhana, the joy completely fills one's being so that there is no part of one's being not filled with joy. Great King, this is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, Great King, one can enter and remain in the third jhana by letting go of the rapture and changing the joy to contentment. One arrives at a place that is very peaceful and equanimous. This contentment completely fills one's being. Imagine, great king, a pond in which lotuses are growing. The lotuses grow up out of the mud into the water, but do not grow out of the water. They live their entire lives in the water, pervaded by water, filled with water. In the same way, the contentment of the third jhana completely pervades and fills one's being. This too is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, and more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, great king, one can enter and remain in the fourth jhana by taking the contentment and bringing it down to a quiet, peaceful stillness, an equanimous state of mind where there is neither pleasure nor pain, neither joy nor sorrow. In this state, one has a clear, bright mind. This clear, bright mind completely fills one's being. Imagine, great king, a man covered from head to foot by a sheet, so that all parts of him are covered by the sheet. In the same way, great king, the clear, bright mind of the fourth jhana fills one's being, so there is no part of one's being not covered with this pure, bright mind. This too is a fruit of the spiritual life, more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, great king, one may take the clear, concentrated, sharp, malleable, wieldy mind generated by doing these jhanas and use it to gain knowledge and vision of things as they are. One can see, this is my body, born of mother and father, fed on rice and gruel, subject to pressing, rubbing, illness, old age. And this is my consciousness, which is bound up with it. One is able to see very clearly how things really are. One is able to gain insight into the nature of things. Great king, this too is a fruit of the spiritual life, more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. Further, great king, by practicing diligently, one can learn magical powers. One can learn to be in two places at once, to hear things that are far away, to see things that are far away, to magically travel great distances, to know the minds of others, to remember past lives. These too are fruits of the spiritual life, visible here and now, more wondrous and more sublime than the other. But they're not important. What's important, great king, is that one can see this is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is how suffering comes to cease. And this is the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And one can see the path very clearly, and one can practice that path to the point where one achieves total enlightenment, where one has done what needs to be done and one has made an end of suffering. This too is a fruit of the spiritual life, visible here and now, more wondrous and more sublime than the previous. And furthermore, great king, there is no fruit of the spiritual life more wondrous or more sublime than this. The king was impressed. Wonderful, marvelous. This is fantastic. It's like you've brought a light into a dark room. It's like you've set upright something that had been knocked down. It's like you pointed out the way to one who is lost. I go to the Buddha for refuge, and to the Dharma and to the Sangha. May the Buddha please consider me a lay follower for the rest of my life. Transgression overcame me, Venerable Sir. For the sake of rulership, I killed my father, a just and honorable man, and a righteous king. May the Buddha please acknowledge my transgression. You did indeed commit a very grave transgression, great king. You killed your father, a just and honorable man, a righteous king. We acknowledge your transgression and your admitting it so that in the future there may be restraint. Then the king said, "We have much to do and we must be going. Do as you see fit, great king." And King Ajusatu and Jivaka and all the people that had come with him went back to their elephants and back to the palace. And after King Ajusatu was gone, the Buddha said to his monks, his company of 1,250 bhikkhus, "That king has ruined himself. That king has destroyed himself. If he had not killed his father, tonight the stainless eye of Dhamma would have been opened in him, and he would have made stream entry. He would have started on the road to enlightenment. But because he killed his father, he will not in this lifetime make much progress on the spiritual path." And the monks were very pleased with all the Buddha had taught them. Now, as a footnote, King Ajusatu went back to the palace that night and had the first good night's sleep he'd had since he killed his father. He became a fairly decent supporter of the Buddha. He was very warlike, though. He made war on his neighbors. And when his son grew up, his son killed him. And when his son's son grew up, he killed his son. And when that son's son grew up, he also killed his father. It happened for 5 generations. And when it happened the 5th time, the people of Magadha said, "Enough of this," and killed the last father-killing king and installed a new dynasty. So this is the sutta from which I have been teaching the last couple of nights. You may have recognized some of the passages. And this is the context in which they appeared. So if you have a few questions,
you mean about the jhana?
About the sutta, which does indeed mention the jhanas. Yes.
You mentioned stream entry. Could you elaborate?
In discussing enlightenment, it is said that there are 10 fetters that bind us, 10 things that keep us in the state of unenlightenment. There are 4 stages of getting rid of these fetters. The first stage is called stream entry. One has entered the stream towards enlightenment. Traditionally, it is said once one has reached stream entry, one will be reborn no more than 7 more times before reaching full enlightenment. It is also said that one will not be born in a realm lower than the human realm. In the Buddhist cosmology, there are some 30 realms. Lower than the human is the animal realm, the realm of the hungry ghost, the realm of the warring gods, and hell. So once one reaches stream entry, one will not be born in one of the lower realms. One will probably come back as a human or one of the lesser gods. The three fetters that go upon stream entry are a belief that rites and rituals will get you any sort of spiritual growth. The intellectual belief in a self. One has an intellectual understanding that the self is just an illusion. It doesn't destroy the illusion, but one at least intellectually understands it. And the third can't remember it right off. And I was talking with someone about it just recently. We'll have to come back to it. The second stage of enlightenment is called a once-returner. When you reach that stage, greed and hatred are cut in half. They are diminished. Oh, the third one in the first stage is skeptical doubt. One no longer doubts that the path will lead to spiritual growth. One understands the Buddha knew what he was talking about. So for the first stage, no belief in rites and rituals, no skeptical doubt, no intellectual belief in the self. The second stage, a once-returner, the greed and hatred are cut in half. They're something like preference for or preference against. And one will only be reborn one more time in the human realm before reaching enlightenment. The third stage is called a non-returner, and greed and hatred are eliminated. One will either make an end to it all by coming totally enlightened in this life, or if one dies before reaching full enlightenment, one will go to one of the God realms, one of the heavens, and will reach enlightenment from there. The final stage, you've still got five fetters to get rid of. That they are desire for material rebirth, desire for immaterial rebirth, ignorance, restlessness and worry. That one sticks around a long time. And what is usually referred to as conceit, but which actually means that you conceive of having a self. Once these five fetters are gone, one reaches total enlightenment. One reaches a state of understanding that there is no separate self, that we are all connected. One sees that so clearly that one never again makes the mistake of operating as though the self were real. One has totally seen through the illusion and never acts selfishly again. So, stream entry is the first stage of enlightenment, then once-returner, non-returner, and full enlightenment. And at each stage, some of the fetters that bind us are released. More questions?
They were shocked.
Tell us a story.
I just told you a story. You're greedy for another one.
Craving.
Okay, the shortest fairy tale of all. Once upon a time, they lived happily ever after. Unfortunately, it has no truth in it. So if there are no more questions, then I'll talk about what the Buddha taught as the very first thing when someone came to him for instruction. It wasn't the precepts, it wasn't the jhanas, it wasn't insight meditation. The very first thing he taught people was generosity. Remember, all this pain and suffering is caused by grasping, by desire. Generosity is a practice of just the opposite, of letting go. If you want to learn to quit doing this, then you should practice doing this. The teachings of the Buddha have been given for free for 2,500 years. The money that you have paid to attend this course pays for the food and the lodging, pays my airfare, pays for the expenses of putting on the course. I do this for free because that's the tradition. And it also seems like the cleanest way to do it. If I did it for money, well, I'd be trying to impress you so you give me lots of money, right? If I do it for free, I do it just because I think it's a valuable thing to do, that it might be of some benefit for you. In return, if you want to make a donation to me, it will be appreciated. There will be two boxes outside, I think. One for Teacher Donna. Donna means generosity. The other for Scholarship Donna. These retreats are fairly expensive. I think all of you know, it's not like, 20 shekels and you go get nice vacation or anything. It costs money. And it's definitely the case that in the West, the middle way seems to be the upper middle way. That it's something that people who have money do, but it shouldn't be just the upper middle way. These teachings should be available to everyone. So there's another box out there for the scholarship fund. Some of the people on this retreat receive scholarships because they simply didn't have the money to pay the full amount. So I would strongly urge you to contribute, if you can, to the scholarship fund. Now, the giving of dana is always accompanied by, how much should I give? You want to ask your neighbor, well, how much do you think we should give? Don't do that. It's noble silence, remember. What you should give should be based upon your ability to give and any value you may have gotten out of the course. If you don't have much money, then you don't have to give anything, right? It's strictly based on your ability to give. This is for free. They're paying my expenses to come over here. I just had a wonderful week in Jerusalem before I started teaching the retreat. My hobby is traveling around the world to really interesting places, and I spent a week in a really interesting place, and I didn't have to buy an airfare ticket to get here. So I'm happy if you don't give anything, because I've already received a great deal. But if you want to give something, yeah, it's good. But definitely think about giving to the scholarship fund, because you'll be helping to build the Sangha here in Israel. You'll be helping other people to understand about it. You'll be supporting what goes on here. This is in your interest, actually. So I think that's all I want to say about it. I think Oren maybe has a word or two he wants to say.
Yeah, I'll say it in English.
So to start, put your attention on the breath for a few moments. Now imagine that growing in your heart is a very large flower garden. A garden filled with the most incredible variety and colors of flowers. Get a sense of how beautiful and how large this garden is. Think of someone that you really care about, someone that you find it easy to love, and pick them a very nice bouquet of flowers from the garden in your heart and give them this bouquet. Think of other people you care about, your family, your friends. Bring these people to mind one by one and give them a nice bouquet that you've picked from the flower garden in your heart. Think of your acquaintances, your co-workers, your neighbors, people you see in the stores that you frequent. Again, bring them to mind one by one and give them a bouquet from the garden in your heart. Think of someone you find difficult and pick that person also a very nice bouquet of flowers and give it to them very nicely. Pick flowers from your heart and give them to the people sitting near you in this meditation hall. And then give flowers to everyone in the meditation hall. give flowers from your heart to everyone here at the monastery. If you look back into your heart, you'll notice that the flower garden is actually even larger now. You have plenty of flowers to give to everybody in this town. You can give flowers to everyone in Jerusalem. Pick flowers from your heart to give to everyone who lives in Israel. And now give flowers to everyone in the Middle East. You've got more flowers than you started with. There's plenty to go around. If you look back into your heart now, you'll see that the flower garden has gotten quite remarkably huge. You have enough flowers to give flowers to everyone on this planet. In places where there are troubles, you've got flowers to put in the barrels of the guns. Now put your attention back in your own heart and notice how much larger the flower garden is. Despite giving away all those flowers, there's more than when you started. It's a funny thing about love. The more you give it away, the more you have. May all beings everywhere be happy.